Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello and welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Mr. Brian Brushwood.
And that's it. That's 100% of the team that matters.
Dude, that's what counts.
We got a rule. If it ain't Western Hemisphere, then there's no need to fear. I just rhymed fear with fear. Also, I don't know if Hawaii is in the Eastern or Western Hemisphere. I think it might be the farthest west you can get.
Yeah, well, let's just put it this way. If you're in Maui sipping pina coladas, whatever, we don't need you on the show right now.
Yeah, in fact, you're officially banned. Anyone
who's banned.
You're banned
for one episode. For the duration of which you are in Hawaii and unable to get internet access, you're off this show.
That's right. But then the moment you come back, we'll welcome you with open arms. Hey, man, besides, we don't need to go to Hawaii to have adventures. Some of us have adventures, harrowing adventures, right here in the good old U.S. of A. Which, again,
true.
I'd like to point out that Hawaii is part of.
Brian, I don't know if you noticed, but my voice is particularly raspy today.
I have noticed. I keep having to bump up your volume here.
Right.
I feel like you might have had some kind of experience.
I had an experience, Brian, but I don't want you to make fun of my voice. I'm not sick. I'm quite well, remarkably well. This is the outcome. You know, you're like, what's with the stupid raspy voice that I have to adjust the volume? Well, Brian, as you know, when one is on your knees supplicating in front of a voodoo priestess, dancing rhythmically back and forth over and over again for an extended period of time, screaming at the top of your lungs for a severed head so you can get a level one point, this is what happens.
Oh my God. This sounds to me like you just had the most epic real life RPG MMO. You either stepped into a portal to World of Warcraft or you had the overnight horror adventure that I wanted so bad to participate in.
So I went to the Great Horror Campout, and it's an event they do around all across America. They did it Friday night, Saturday night here in L.A. They're going to be in Austin. They're going to be in Oakland. And what was really cool what they did here is they set it up. It's an overnight campout. Starts at 8 p.m. and it goes to 8 a.m. in the morning. In L.A., there's the old L.A. Zoo. And if you've ever seen old movies where they have, like, zoos and, like, just the cages look like the saddest things in the world. I think it was maybe, like, Planet of the Apes, one of the sequels or something. You see the cage and just it's shallow.
Yeah.
You know, you're like, and that's where this is. Those cages are still there. And so you have a campground there. You got those cages around the tents. And then they have all these paths and all these different things. You go off in different directions. And so, you know, you're in the middle of the night. You're in this creepy zoo. And they actually had to send everybody to the center of, like, the main area where there was a movie screen. And then one of the people told me that, yeah, we had a rattlesnake, and we had to
First of all, back everything up, because we spent, like, 30 minutes going over the brochure for this thing, like a bunch of 12-year-olds just amped up like it's a space adventure. And there was all different things I was wondering, like what exactly are the rules? And it was clear that there was some kind of progression and contests and talent events or talent shows, it was mentioned.
Yeah, so here's
like,
the thing.
I guess can just start me off. Just give me a picture of the first like 10, 15 minutes of orientation, because they have to there have to be a few things they like hammer on very first thing. And that's what I'm most curious about.
So what it is you go in there and you sit in front of, like, they have a stage, and that's the main area. And then you go up this path to where the tents are and the different sections for the tents. And there's other paths to different directions in the woods where there's freaky Mothmen, and there's a labyrinth with Chupacabra, etc. The guy who runs it, he's the head counselor. He's the guy that runs the whole thing. He's got some sort of freakish makeup on it. He's fantastic. He's just, you know, this presence that keeps driving the whole thing. He's like, orange tents, you've got to report to, you know, blood tug of war. And if you don't, you're blankety expletive, expletive, expletive. You know, I mean, it's just funny kind of stuff. You know, just the guy, his banter was really good.
So they're not selling like an alternate reality. This isn't like, welcome to Camp Zombie Protection. You know, we've got to support the front lines. This is just like in a postmodernist way. It just is what it is of its own accord without explanation or backstory or.
Yeah, I mean, you're going to a summer camp that's a horror, that's surrounded by horrific hill people and everything else that will torment you and whatever. And they're your counselors. And it's, yeah, it's the thing I didn't appreciate as much was it's really a scavenger hunt. It's really a scavenger hunt. And I had a great time. I really enjoyed it. I brought a friend. She had a lot of fun. But it was such that the problem was, like, I'm not a scavenger hunt guy. I'm not a guy that likes to run out and chase down stuff. And one of the problems is like you go through, they have these corpses where you have to dig in there and grab things out of there. But there's several hundred people here. And by the time you get to them, they're picked clean. And they'll be like, oh, we'll replenish them throughout the night. And you go back there two or three times, they're picked clean. So
this is like the real life MMO experience. You walk there, you walk up and there's a bunch of people all hanging around. They're like, what's going on? You're like, we're waiting for the spawn, you know, for new loot to appear.
Oh, yeah, everybody's in, yeah, and they would do it in kind of a weird way is the way they do that, get everybody to one location, they would do that, and so they tried to make that as invisible as they could, you know. People who ran it, I mean, the people, the actors and all that, really good, always in character, really committed, and it was a lot, and there's a lot of really cool fun zones and stuff. My thing was just, I didn't realize how much it was just, if you're not doing the scavenger hunt, don't go. You know,
you got to be in it to play the game.
And the problem with scavenger hunt is like there's like one master level prize, and people who went before, they knew where to go. You know, they knew how the game is played, and so you're kind of like, oh, what do we do now? And then you go there and like, oh, we're all out. And you're like, oh. But that being said, it'd be fun if you have a group of people. It really, really, you know, it's fun. It was just a neat experience. The food sucked because it was vegan food. So. As Woody Allen says, the portions were small and they were horrible. You know, but that chili was pretty good. The chili is pretty good. But you go there at like 8 o'clock and you get a little thing of chili and cornbread, and then you're like, "All right, that's it." But
okay, but there has to be. I mean, in 12 hours, is it? It's not just 12 hours of scavenger hunt, though.
So you do. You go do scavenger hunt, and then you get your tent. You're in different zones, like your tent zone, and so you might get pulled in. Like we were in the black section, so we would get called. They like, you know, all blacks in tent section, come to tug of war. You got to do tug of war, and then you get a bracelet. And if you get that, and again, the bracelet only plays into if you go for some master level thing. And that was my problem. There's like no other minor achievements. You get one thing, you get your t-shirt, and then if you want to collect everything, which is really hard, and you got to do all things you're not supposed to, run, elbow people out of the way, and do all that, you know, to get the Hellmaster.
And that there is, I would imagine, because I've played, you know, similar games and situations where it's like I felt at some level just an aspect of defeat, like what's the point, a futility to it. Like if I can't get this, then why am I bothering?
Because we were like, my friend Melanie and I were like, well, let's just have fun. And then, you know, it's kind of like you go do this because it's like, well, if you could get like, if there were intermediate kind of things you could get that were kind of cool, that would be neat. And maybe there, and it's, I felt like it wasn't quite as explained to me as it could have been. And the map was not very helpful. And we almost missed entire sections there. Again, you know, it's, they put on an amazing thing, but you just kind of go like, man, how would this be better?
How many people were there, do you think, total?
Maybe 200 or 300.
Okay.
Yeah.
So 200 or 300, and the focus was the scavenger hunt, but there's also talk about like grabbing people out of tents and stuff. Did any of that happen?
So they do it, you know, the middle of the night, like after like you're at 2:30, like, all right, time for bed. And then you're in the middle of the night, like 4:30 in the morning, you know, hillbillies will come and try and drag you out of your tent.
And then, I mean, could you kick him away and say, no, sir, I would rather sleep.
Yeah, you could try. You're not allowed to touch them, but you can, like, they ripped open our tent and they tried grabbing stuff, and I just pulled the stuff back and then they left. But what's funny is you knew when something was about to happen because they were taping this with a quadcopter, and you'd hear the and like 4:30 in the morning I hear I'm like, quadcopters, they're taping something, so
okay,
get ready.
Real quick, do you realize if we time traveled 22 years ago and freaking like you had just come out of Terminator 2 and you're like, well, in the future it won't be like this, but it'll be close enough that you and I will have unironically a conversation in which you say, well, you always knew when the soldiers were coming because you'd hear the drones approach first. I mean, it's like, how amazing is the fact that we live in this world, and how great is it that we pay for a weekend retreat instead of being enslaved by the robots?
True that. Well, we'll get into that a little bit later. So now I think if you like horror stuff, do it. By all means, do it. And be prepared for scavenger hunt. Have your game face on, and you will really – I'm a guy like – I just like to walk around and explore and have people go, boo, you know.
So you'd like it better if it – you know, that's one thing that I think Universal Halloween Horror Nights always did really well was that there was always multiple levels. If you wanted to do I'm hearing a little bit of myself echo. If you wanted to do haunted houses, there was a ton of them there. If you wanted to just hang out, they had like safe areas and scare areas. And of course, there was the rides and stuff. This one was very more like one main track.
They, they have like a very like, hey, sit around and watch movies and do arts and crafts sort of track.
Yeah.
But it's like, it's sort of thing like there could be a kind of an intermediary, you know. And again, they evolve this thing over every year. A lot of thought goes in this. Again, I don't mean, I'm just being my own little not being a scavenger hunt guy. My thing. I think it was a great experience. I highly recommend anybody go see it, you know.
All right. So explain to us the scene that you opened everything with you holding a severed head and worshiping for a point.
Go up this dark path. And in order to get in there, we had to have like find a candle or something. We go up this dark path, and there are people dressed like they're about, you know, doing a voodoo ceremony, and they wait and wait, and they tell you to go away, like go away. But you stick around, and finally some guy starts beating the drums, and then a bunch of like voodoo dancers come out there and start doing like, you know, ensemble voodoo dance, and you're supposed to participate. And they'll pull point to one, you know, whoever's really into it, they pointed to one girl and they're like, all right, take your shirt off, you know. So she takes off her shirt. You're like, all right, get on the ground, bark like a dog, you know. And she barks like a dog, you know, like, and do that, you know. They make her do all these very denigrating things, and then they pull out this severed head, which is the prize, like, make out with the head, you know. So you mix out with the head, da da da.
Oh, and my god. They
pointed to me and they're like, you step forward, and a couple other guys. And then I'm like, all right, I was like the first person there with my friend, and I'm like, I'm gonna go all the way. Next thing, you're like, on my knees, you know, bark like we're all barking like dogs, and like all the other guys are. So I'm elbowing my way through, going to the front of the line, doing everything I'm supposed to do, bark, scream, jump, whatever. They pull out the head and like, make out with the head. I made out with the head. I sucked face with that fake head, like, you know, there was no tomorrow.
I'll tell you what, there's something, and no matter how constructed, oh my god, you look great. No matter how constructed this scenario is that you have going into it, there is something about the power of ritual that is utterly hypnotic. You know, I did 20 years ago, I did Mystery School with Jeff McBride, right? You get, you know, Eugene Berger telling ghost stories, and, you know, it's where I meet Christian Shellman and a few other folks. It's where I met Kevin James and Dan Harlan. And, you know, there's a heavy emphasis on ritual and drum beating and masks, and like there's some creepy like hive mind stuff that just sort of takes over. And it doesn't matter that this guy's a PhD in linguistics over here and this guy's a, you know, talented sleight of hand person. Something takes over, and I totally see how, especially in tribal times, that kind of ecstatic experience in a place where, you know, beer might be in short supply would be the number one mind-altering experience of choice.
Yeah, I mean, there's that. And then also, like, the competitive, like, things I don't like scavenger hunts, because once I get competitive, I get vicious.
Yeah.
And I don't like that. Because, like, once I'm, like, committed to that, I'm like, I'm going to win this. I'm going to elbow people out of the way. I'm going to push through there. I'm going to do whatever I can. And I got the head. I won, you know? And it was just, and I'm like, I don't want to be, I won't have as much fun if I'm doing that, though. So.
Yeah. So if, for you, if the experience, if there was a track where you could say, I want to experience all of this, I don't want it to be a competition for me, though, you would have taken that track.
Yeah, if it were more like, hey, you know, get this, get a merit badge, do this, do a merit badge kind of thing, that would, for me, that would be more fun, I think.
Yeah. But now, was there somebody else there who were, for lack of a better word, lifers, you know, people who
Yeah, there are people. I ran into a couple of friends, one friend who had been the year before. And so you go, people like, because I think this is the second year it's in L.A. And that's the thing, is like, these people know what to do. And so, like, your first year, it's like, it's going to be hard as heck to, you know, to get the high thing, because, like, you know, to get that head was really, really hard. And you have to get like three things like that. And, you know, then they had some other thing where they're like, oh, tell us your darkest secret. And some guy next to me goes, I like Justin Bieber. And they're like, you win. And you're like, really?
Yeah.
You know, like, I spent 20 minutes screaming to the top of my lungs for this severed head. Yeah. I made out with this severed head.
Yeah.
You know, and then some guy makes a joke and he gets it. So it's like, anyhow, Brian, enough of that.
What?
If you want to check out Great Horror Campout, greathorrorcampout.com. Check out if it's coming to a place near you. Brian, we got a lot of stuff to talk about here.
Do we? Are you saying that a bunch of weird things happened this week?
Brian, a lot of weird things happened. Okay,
One weird thing, sir.
Well, cool thing coming up. I don't know how to pronounce, but remember the Antikythera, the ancient computer they found in the Roman shipwreck that had the Greek symbols on it, they believe was made for calculating the orbits of, you know, the planets and lunar events and possibly tides?
I actually don't remember this, but I'm looking at it. Antikythera mechanism on Wikipedia. This is the thing right here, right?
Yeah. So they found this in a shipwreck around like 1900. Sponge divers or whatever found it. And it was this rusted thing. And for the longest time, nobody realized what it was till they x-rayed and they looked inside and there were gears and all sorts of other mechanical devices. And this was, you know, in some ways it was considered, you know, one of these things that was an impossibility given what we knew at the time. It's 1,000 years before anything else like that. Maybe not until the 1300s.
Okay, so this was found in, you said, the 1900s, is that right?
Yeah, like 1901 or 1902.
Okay, and it dates back thousands of years. And I swear, if you looked at this, for those, you know, not seeing us live, it looks like a gear mechanism straight out of, I mean, to be honest, like I'm playing the new Wolfenstein game. It seems like something that would be right at home in there. Lots of gears and tumblers.
We didn't, if you, the historical record, we weren't making things like this until the 1300s, you know, started to make complex clockwork. And, you know, and really good, by the way, spring mechanisms, which this does not have to my knowledge, didn't exist until like, I think the 1700s or 1600s or 1700s. But anyhow, it was 1400 years before we expected something like this. And then there are a lot of things or passages in ancient texts and stuff. Like if you went to, like, you know, the Rhodes, you know, the city of Rhodes, you would hear about, they said there were mechanical statues that would move at every street corner. And there's a lot of accounts of these mechanical things. And I believe that these things were very much real. And you had people, craftsmen, who would make these things for kings or rich people. But the problem was, is that they would break down after the guy who made it was done. And you just, you know, they're not around anymore because they'd break down. You pull them out of the palace, wherever it was. You go for the parts. And then these things are exceedingly rare to begin with. But there are a lot of accounts of really interesting devices. But anyhow, this mechanism is fascinating. And we've been able to make what we think are reconstructions of it. And it shows that the Greeks had a much more command of mechanical devices than we realized. What's interesting about this is they found what they think may have been one or two extra parts, which suggests that there might be another mechanism. And so now there's an expedition using one of these hard-shell diving suits to go back down to the ship to go look for another one of these.
Man, that's like straight out of an episode of G.I. Joe, where it's like, you know, it's like the first season ends and they're like, you know, we believe we found parts to, you know, it's more powerful twin. And now, like, we got to go before Cobra to get all the pieces to construct it.
Well, and this is what I'm saying. So, like, if this object, if we hadn't seen this object right now, and if the Sun Sponge Divers hadn't happened upon this one wreck, this one little piece, this entire history of mechanical capabilities would be unknown to us. We'd have no idea about this, and we'd be sitting here thinking, like, yeah, and nothing like that existed until the 1400s.
You know, and
who knows what else is down there?
I mean, first of all, I do wonder what else is down there, but it's so fascinating to me the way we have, I don't want to say that we worship the present or whatever, but we just assume that everyone was dumb 20 minutes ago and that nobody could do anything. Like we saw this with, there were tribes that were able to recognize that, Sirius is a binary star or whatever. And, which I think I'm getting the wrong star, whatever. And they're like, well, clearly they couldn't have known because of they didn't have any optics and they wouldn't have any trade. And then it's only later they're like, well, no, they had a robust trade and there were, you know, Westerners coming down in the 1600s who would be able to explain this stuff and maps and so on. And then it's like, them pyramids are real big and they were dumb back then, so they couldn't have made the pyramids. Must have been space aliens. And now we're starting to see it with stuff just 60 years ago where it's like, Yeah. What? We didn't have computers. Computers were dumb back then. We couldn't go to the moon. When meanwhile, the fundamentals of gears and mechanics, the fundamentals of Newtonian physics, the fundamentals of, you know, of astronomy haven't changed. And those people had a lot. The smart people back in the day had a lot of time on their hands to do this stuff. So I don't understand what the appeal is, what the draw is that causes us all to marvel and believe that it's not possible for our grandparents to have done anything scientifically impressive.
Yeah, I'll blow your mind with something really cool. All right. I didn't tell you about this. All right. And then this was sort of I apologize because this is a little bit of
for those of you guys just tuning in, Andrew is doing chant.
I've been doing some research, Brian, for another project I'm writing. And this is sort of really just peripherally related to it, not at all, but I found this doing a little Google search. Do you know the difference between a dirigible and a blimp?
I believe, forgive me if I'm wrong here, I believe that a dirigible or a Zeppelin has hard sides and a blimp, like there's a scaffolding, a framework in a dirigible, but a blimp is just an inflated balloon?
Yes, sir. Like dirigible, they're rigid. They're rigid, you know, the rigid part of it. So, you know, the 1920s and 30s were interesting because I've been doing a lot of research on like airships, you know, things like that. And, you know, the size of these things, I think we've mentioned before, you know, we had like the USS Akron, which carried like 90 people, could have carry 250,000 pounds of cargo, was 1,000 feet long. And this was in our Navy. We had actual airships in our Navy. I found out about another airship. I had no idea. Didn't even know this was possible. We had a thing called the ZMC-2. ZMC-2. Okay. And
this is, when you say we, you're talking about the United States?
United States Navy. It was the contract to have this thing built. The ZMC was built in 1929. It was scrapped in 1941. And by scrapped, we mean this. It was a solid metal airship. Well, I mean, it was, the inside was filled with, you know, helium, Brian.
Well, of course. Yeah, no, it wasn't a floating lead ingot. It was, but, all right, I'm looking at a picture of it here. It looks just like the freaking Goodyear blimp.
But it's or it looks like Fat Man or Little Boy or a giant bomb because it's matte. That's a completely metal exterior. And it's made of this aluminum alloy. And if you look at construction photos of this thing when they're building it, it's amazing because you see this thing is basically like they have half of it, that top, you know, the front half of it's on its – the nose cone's pointing up. There you go. If you scroll down there, you might see some photos of this thing. So this was a solid metal thing.
Does that mean that there was no scaffolding on the inside?
No, there was a scaffolding the same as an airplane has.
Okay. Okay, but it was surrounded. God, that's astonishing. Do they weld it shut to keep it airtight?
They riveted. They riveted the thing shut.
Are you kidding me?
Okay, this thing is riveted shut, and in fact, what was fascinating about it is that they said that it had a higher, it was able to hold its helium much longer than other forms
A better seal than a balloon.
Yep.
Riveted shut.
Yep.
Okay, so is the thinking, is the motivation, like, I guess they just, number one, obviously, if it held its helium longer, then riveting certainly worked. Number two, I would guess that, like, could it withstand being shot or anything?
I think that they were looking for, to be honest with you, I don't know what the full rationale was, but I think that they were looking at that point, you know, the evolution of where these things would go to and to move from something that was fabric and could rip to something metal and, you know, would be much more puncture resistant.
It just seems like I guess I could see a world where that would just be the more civilized thing to do, right? You know, you don't go to war with fabric that could be torn. You go to war with, boy, this is astonishing. There's a decent enough close up here, and all you have to do is search for ZMC-2. One of these close ups, you can see all the individual panels that each look like they're maybe 3 feet wide and. Mm-hmm.
I'm going to send you this website I'm sending to you now actually has photos of the construction of it.
Okay.
And you can see when the upright cone is being – and you just appreciate the fact that it's not just – it's not like it's aluminum foil stretched across a frame.
Oh, dude, this thing is like standing erect vertically. Like it looks like a rocket, to be honest. Yeah. So it's like it's once you set your mind – like picture a missile, but then picture pointing to a missile – pointing up to the sky and saying, yeah, by the way, that's filled with helium and has a better seal than a balloon.
And you know, and people might look at that and go, well, you know, remember how thick or thin the lunar lander was. You know, they're afraid the astronauts would kick it and kick through the metal.
Yeah. Okay. That's a good point.
So this was a solid metal thing. I mean, amazing. I didn't know that it was, you know, light enough they're able to do it. And, you know, there was some question of, you know, how fast it would be. It turned out it was a lot faster than they realized. And, you know, there was, you know, building it was interesting because part of the problem, helium and air mixes really well together. And when you wanted to, you have this big giant thing where normally a balloon, you just fill the bag up like that.
Right.
Where here you had this solid chamber. And so
you needed to get one out and the other one in.
So what they said was, all right, well, let's fill it with carbon dioxide, which is a lot easier to, because we'll put the helium through the top and the carbon dioxide comes out through the bottom. And so they're about to do this and somebody's like, oh, wait a second. Carbon dioxide is going to weigh several tons more than the helium.
It won't be able to support the weight.
Yeah, we got to build a scaffold on the outside so this thing doesn't topple over. But anyhow, as you're saying, like, you know, we've only built one of these. We built one of these in 1929, okay? We built a metal lighter than air metal airship, solid metal from head to toe, and we've never built one since.
So picture, okay, looking at it now, and to get a sense of scale, this thing's what, the length of a football field, would it be safe to say?
It was actually like 140 feet long or something, so it's remarkably compact, 150 feet long.
Okay, and so we're picturing these panels being, you think they're what, like maybe a millimeter or less thick? You know, kind of like
they were pretty thin for everything.
Yeah. So picture it, like looking at it now, if I picture it made of soda can material, I can buy it. I mean, look, I don't doubt it, but I'm just saying, like, to wrap my mind around how that's possible, I can get in there.
And I'll bring this up because, you know, there is a like Wired Online. I love Wired. They've got a lot of great articles there. Wired's one of my favorite places for long form journalism. But they have like this habit every now and then, like I think it was Wired or IO9, like, let's deconstruct the Shield helicarrier and like why it's impossible. And they're like, well, assuming that it's built like a battleship. Well, no. Yeah. Why are you assuming that?
Yeah.
And I was frustrated to read this because it's like, why don't you start with our actual history of lighter than airships employed in the military, like our dirigibles we used in the 1920s that could carry 250,000 pounds and had 90 people on board and airplanes could land, could hook up to and detach from.
Yeah. Well, I mean, at the end of the day, you got some blogger who's being paid to make 20 articles a day. But
it's far more interesting to me to go, well, wait a second. You know what? Like if we followed the path of this all metal airship to its conclusion and say we still had large spaces that we had to put helium inside of whatever, maybe we could have built, you know, and you could have built an aircraft carrier out of this. You could have put a runway on top of it. You could have done that.
Yes, you could have done all those. I don't know that you'd be able to support, you know, like Harrier jets on it when it's in the sea.
Well, remember that as I mentioned before, the USS Akron, which we used, it actually had planes hook up, could carry 250,000 pounds worth of cargo.
Wow.
The problem is there's stability issues. It's, you know, they're sitting targets.
Wait, oh my God. Yeah. So wait, you are talking about another dirigible, 250,000 pounds in the freaking sky.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
There was a point when you could go into the Navy and you could serve aboard a flying aircraft carrier.
That's pretty dope.
Yeah.
Okay, an aircraft carrier an aircraft carrying aircraft.
Now, I was just in New York, and I went on the USS Intrepid, which is the aircraft carrier up there that served in World War II. Mm-hmm. That's like 1,000 feet long. The USS Akron was 785 feet long.
Really?
And it had the same, roughly the same width across. So this is the thing, the size of an aircraft carrier.
That's so awesome. Now, it says wreckage. Did the Akron go down?
Yeah, severe weather. That's the problem with these things.
We get real excited. We're like, yeah, let's go for it. Well, there's problems.
You get a little bit of a wind, and you shouldn't. Know, they were an exciting idea, and then aircraft just developed so much more at a faster pace to the point that you put one of these things up there, then short of like, you know, send them over England and try to bomb them, they weren't going to be as practical because the event, you know, you put one guy in a biplane, gets close enough, you could take it down.
Yeah, and I'm guessing while probably not 250,000 pounds, my guess is that the payload of like a, you know, an Airbus 777 or whatever, Dreamliner 777 or whatever, would probably be impressive as well.
Yeah, maybe, I'm sure. So, but anyhow, you think about the future from that point of view, as we talk about like in the 1920s when you were thinking these things were real.
Oh. Yeah, like not nowadays they're I don't know, we look at them as hilarious anachronistic constructs. Again, I'm going back to some of the beautiful design in Wolfenstein, but man, for that to just be science fact, as they put it, it's pretty amazing.
So just the question somebody asked is a valid one. What are the practical things other than dropping bombs? Well, like the Akron, they would thought about you could do aircraft support cargo delivery. There were the ideas that you could deliver troops across enemy lines. And this was a point before aircraft, in the 1930s, we started building, the Curtiss Air Company started building bigger aircraft, but we were still trying to figure out what was the shape of the future going to be. Mm-hmm. And then in retrospect, we look at how large airplanes became, how relatively reliable they became, and it's easy to understand that. But at that point, we didn't know. But then when after a number of these things, between the Hindenburg, between a lot of these things crashing, we realized these things are – they're not – it's the going up and down is kind of a problem because they're very susceptible to weather.
Well, and what's weird is the ways that we're revisiting – those ideas where we have like the I don't know, the Google Loon, is that what it is, the mm-hmm. the plan to have permanent floating
already took out the power in a neighborhood when one of them crashed into a power lines.
Did it really?
So
don't be hating on the balloons.
Yeah. No, and I think we're an exciting point now. There are companies that want to build now what we have. This was built in 1920s technologies. It was pre-composites, pre-plastics, really, effectively. And the materials we have now, who knows? Don't be afraid to dream big. So, speaking of amazing things, Brian.
Yeah.
We try not to mention it every episode unless there's something really cool going on.
I'm already going to let's see, S-P-A-C-E.
Yeah. Now, we had two really cool, product announcements in the last couple of weeks. One for, developers, the Apple thing, which was kind of exciting to see where that was going, if you're into that. But before that, I think the best product announcement I have seen in my entire life, and again, I'm a devoted Steve Jobs fan, but I think it was Elon Musk's SpaceX, because when you can do a product unveiling where it ends, where you step into your spaceship and sit in the captain's chair.
Dude, okay, so this – and you're right. I guess I forgot that was this week that this happened. The Dragon V2 unveiling event was number one. It was like E3. It felt like so ultimately over the top, so freaking Iron Man. I adored it, and it was amazing because shortly after this announcement, I started getting emails from everybody peripherally involved on it saying stuff like, for example, NVIDIA says, by the way, NVIDIA graphics technology in space, and it was really great.
Yeah, it's I get the Google News alerts, and so whenever, you'll hear, such and such, which has worked with SpaceX on this. And so those of you who don't know, Elon Musk of SpaceX, they unveiled their next generation capsule to go on top of their Falcon spacecraft. And this is for part of the funding came from NASA for their crew delivery program. It is called the Dragon 2, and it can carry 7 people into space to the International Space Station and then back down. But you're like, hey, guys, we've been doing that since a guy named Yuri Gagarin. Oh, but here's the difference.
It's I don't know. You almost picture him saying oh, let me guess, pureed peas, astronaut lunches with freeze-dried ice creams. Boring. Let's take it to the next level, gentlemen.
So,
I was gonna say, how far into this do they drop the curtain? I want to actually see.
Yeah, it's only 13 minutes long to watch it, so it's worth it. But so what? What makes this special, makes the Dragon 2 special, again, this is a thing they're beginning, ready to begin testing now. The thing on stage is not supposed to be some mock-up. It's supposed to be an actual thing. It can land without a parachute. It uses retro rockets to go from Earth orbit back down to the Earth.
It's a freaking spaceship.
It's a spaceship.
And when you see it inside now, when you look on the outside, you're like, well, that looks like the top of a missile. Just like, didn't you just show us that made in 1920s?
Kind of sexy. The way those rocket engines are folded under there are kind of cool. I'm just saying. I'm a little aroused, Brian.
Fully functional rocket that he shows. And once you go inside, man, it's unreal. So they explain the mechanics of getting up and payloads and that stuff. But then when you come home, look at that. Not when you come back to your planet...
Yeah. And by the way, one of the things that they've said about this is it can land on any hard surface in the solar system.
God, that's so great. This whole, it's happening. It's really happening.
Yeah.
So we're seeing a mock-up right now, it's computer generated, sure. But basically when it comes down, it has that brief moment of, the shuttlecock kind of, everything getting white hot. Because fire comes at you when you're in space, and then it starts firing the rockets, and it basically just skids its way slower and slower. I can't believe that there's enough fuel to slow it all the way down inside that little it just doesn't seem like there should be enough fuel to slow that thing.
Yeah, well, that was the debate, you know, and that's what SpaceX has been spending the last decade trying to figure out. And what's really cool is when he watches this video, the foreground is framed because suspended from the ceiling is the first Dragon capsule to go up and come back down. And what's significant about that right now is other than, to my knowledge, other than when we use the Soviet hardware, all the other companies that have stuff, they don't come back down. They incinerate back when they go into the Earth's atmosphere because short of the shuttle and
and even then it's debatable. It's up for argument just how reusable the shuttle.
Why it's reusable? I mean, I don't say reusable. I'm saying no. Everything else burns up, doesn't come back down.
Right. Right.
What we're doing, resupply, all the things we send resupply right now to the ISS, other than the Russian, you know, the Soviet era, but the Russian designed capsules, all the other private ones, all the other countries, they deliver their cargo, then they burn up in the atmosphere. They don't come back down. And so the first Dragon was able to do that. And now this Dragon.
And I guess we're going in stages here too, where it's like, this obviously of everything you want to be able to deliver and bring back, hopefully in reusable format, the crew module would be the biggest one. But the fact that this is all part of a long game and they fully intend to have all three stages just have a happy jaunt back to Earth. And all of a sudden we're just refueling. Dude, how'd you like to be those guys? Your job is to whip out the stairs for Elon Musk to step into his spaceship.
and I'll tell you what's interesting too is you look at this thing. On one hand, you can forget the sense of scale, but then you watch, you know, as Musk walks up the stairs to his spaceship to climb inside.
Look at this thing. This thing is amazing. And there's so much free space. That's what I don't understand. And part of it, I'm sure, is that it's a very wide angle lens. Yeah. In there, you can see he seems to grow gigantically. But they've got these, instead of these giant padded seats, like instead it looks, to be honest, of everything I've seen in science fiction, this looks closest to the interior of the pod in what was the Sagan movie? Contact.
Yeah. But I think these chairs are mounted better.
Yeah. Look at this.
He's got this pull-down display, you know.
It feels an awful lot like if you've ever ridden the Mission to Mars experience at Disney. Like the whole, like, you sit in and it leans back and then you pull the console down to you. And it's got all the graphics. Like if I saw these graphics in a modern science fiction movie, I would be slightly annoyed because it would look like, that's so fake. That's not how they build spaceships.
Where'd they get those seats, Tesla?
Yeah, exactly. It's just amazing. I highly recommend watching all of it. And the walkthrough is astonishing. And of course, all the numbers. I unfortunately, haven't you heard, Andrew? There's the odds of us making it to Mars in the next 86 years are virtually nil.
Oh, so there's like, I think the National Science Academy released this paper talking about like, if we want to go to Mars, we're going to have to partner with somebody because there's no way we'd be able to afford to be able to do it, which was like within like, you know, by the end of the century. And I said a thing to Brian. I'm like, that's like somebody in the Lincoln administration saying that, you know, it'll be 1969 before we make it to the moon.
Yes.
You know, it's like it makes no sense at all, you know, for us to be, you know, for anybody to be, anybody who thinks they can make some sort of prediction that far out has no business making predictions.
Yeah. Yeah,
there could be all sorts of things that come into play, but this the idea that, oh no, we won't have the capability.
Well, and that's the problem is when you get in the business, it's a bad business to be in, the business of saying what mankind is not going to be able to do, and it's littered with the hilarious corpses of one-liners from history's greatest minds.
And you know, I'm, you know, one of the things I bristle at, and that's when I went into the thing about the whole, we could not have faked the moon landing in 1969 video because, you know, to my opinion, you know, the arguments that he made for why we couldn't have were specious, like, oh, we didn't have film canisters that were this big. And like Andy Warhol was using 33-minute film canisters, but he didn't mention that, you know, and there's things like that are like, it was just like, yeah, we went to the moon. Absolutely went to the moon, but let's not make bogus art and let's not say we couldn't have done this thing or we can't do this thing because there are smarter people
out
there.
Let's not essentially make the exact same mistake that people, that moon deniers are doing, which is basically, which is basically what we were talking about just two segments ago, which was, back then people be dumb. They couldn't have done it, you know? And it's a bad argument no matter which side that that you make it on.
Yeah, I mean, you look at the available evidence, and you can say if a thing, you know, it's hard to, you can't prove a negative, essentially. And you have to look at the evidence, but to say what can't be done or won't be done is just based in the future, is not the past. It's not a bigger version of the past.
Yeah.
So speaking of things that were supposed to not be able to get done, there has been a big shakeup that came out today, Brian.
Oh man, that was today. I can't believe how fast things are changing.
Or yesterday, but yeah, I mean, it was announced. Now we've talked about the Turing test before. Alan Turing came up with this idea, and it basically kind of took off on a philosophical idea that if we were to create an artificially intelligent computer or system, how do we know if it's conscious or not? And he touched upon a very important philosophical argument. How do I know that anybody else is conscious?
Yeah,
I don't.
And keep in mind, there's two layers to it. If you're not familiar with Turing's amazing story, he eventually predicted the rise of machines. Never actually – he synthesized the entire concept of artificial computing, the way it exists to this day, with the hypothetical idea of a print head that could write zeros and ones and read it, and an infinitely long piece of tape. And from that, he figured out, well, okay, so computers are going to be a thing, and I'll bet somebody can write a routine that would simulate a person. How would you figure out the difference between a person and a computer? And then to hit that next level, like you mentioned, Andrew, of saying, well, how do I know anyone else is? And to come up with such a practical, and it's not a perfect thing. It doesn't say, it doesn't prove that anything has a soul or anything like that. He says, you know, the test is if all things being equal, you can't tell the difference between a artificial intelligence and an actual intelligence, then for all intents and purposes, that's as real intelligence as you can ever prove. Because beyond that, like you said, you can't prove that anyone else has intelligence.
Exactly. And that's what gets to the heart of it. People will come up with like, well, we know this about, like, you know, we can talk about how we think internally, and we can dissect somebody else and do that. But end of the day is what we regard as consciousness is the expression of how things are sort of done. Because I can't know your inner monologue. I can't know what's really going on there within reason. And so the idea is the fairest way is to say, if it fools you into thinking that it's human, then you might as well say, I give it the potential that it's conscious.
Yeah.
You know, and consciousness is one of these, you know, there's still these big mysteries. You know, I think we'll be building really intelligent conscious machines and still not understanding how it works.
Well, and so why are we talking about it today?
Well, we're talking about it today because, Brian, they do periodically, there have been tests where they actually have computers try to pass the Turing test. And the essential idea, as he described it, is you would ask somebody questions, and you would ask, you know, through some sort of intermediary that would maybe transcribe them or whatever. And you'd ask questions, and I'd have an opportunity to keep asking questions. And then at the end of that, I have to decide if I'm talking to a human or not. And one of the ways that it was described, if you would have, let's say, more than 30% of the people were convinced that you were human, then effectively it passed the Turing test. It fooled 30% of people into thinking that this was human.
Well, and in a perfect Turing test, it would be a completely unrestricted voice-based conversation with some, either, you know, through a screen looking at what you think is the face of another person or whatever. You could decide just how perfect is for it to be. And historically, when they've had these competitions, they've had to do things like limit the scope of the conversation. We're like, well, you need to just talk about rocketry. That's the only thing you're allowed to talk about. And you know, there were tricks people could do to make things feel more human. For example, insult you randomly or say they're not interested in that or challenge you. All these things that essentially they were baking in surprises. But nobody has ever just full on fooled, and again, even the 30% people or whatever is kind of an arbitrary line to cross. But can you tell me, was this totally unrestricted, or was it based on a certain thing, or was he up against 13-year-olds? Because this was allegedly Eugene Goostman, a 13-year-old boy.
So the way the test was done is they had a mixture of panel of people who were doing the evaluations, and one of which was actually Crichton, the guy who played Crichton in Red Dwarf, which was kind of amusing. And so, and that's going to be the next thing, is people are going to qualify and say, well, are the people who are doing the judging valid or whatever? Because we've had, just a side note, there have been like there have been chat bots, like Eliza, I think was one that you can put into chat rooms and people will carry on conversations. Certain kinds of people will carry on conversation with them and never realize they're talking to a robot. And I think it's a way to, you know, diagnose extremely narcissistic people, I think. But we have things that can fool people who aren't really credible at telling this. So that will be the next question, is like, what should be the mixture of the panel be, et cetera. But, you know, it's pretty much the first solid test by an institution that thinks that this is the University of Reading says, you know, they think that there are other places that tried to do tests before, but they say think theirs is the fairest, more accurate thing to do. And this computer program came close back in like 2012 of passing. And effectively, in what it's able to do is one of the questions you want to ask, you'd say, hey, you know, I have a pet dog. His name is Joe. Can you name what pets I may have? You know,
so like a logical conundrum where anyone who actually truly was understanding you would understand the different elements and piece together what you're asking.
Yeah. Things at the simple context, just a very simple context change. You know, I have a pet named Joe. Could you tell me the name of my dog? You know, and then you'd have to go, oh, pet means dog, da, 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 back and forth. And things that we just take for granted and a 6-year-old could do.
Yeah.
And so a lot of times they would trump. They'd go, oh, and they would have clever ways of out to like, oh, pets are fun. I love pets. Da, da, da. What's the name? You know, what's the name of my dog? Like, what's the name of the dog? Well, whatever you want to call it, you know?
Or I don't know. What's the name of my dog?
And so you can very easily make programs like that give these pat flip response like Eliza would do and just turn it back like, no, tell me about you. You know, that's one of those things that works. And you could pass, you know, you could, certain people would fall for it. They wouldn't realize there's an evasion there. Here, you know, one of the questions was like, you know, my car is red. You know, what kind of car, what color would you, you know, is the car in my driveway? It's red. You know, he would answer you, tell you these things, these very simple things connecting those statements.
So here's what's astonishing to me. This quote here, Kevin Warwick says that a computer that can think and act like a person will be an asset to battling cybercrime. Quote, online real-time communication of this type can influence an individual human in such a way that they are fooled into believing something is true when in fact it is not. Understand, like, a big way that they battle cybercrime is by having undercover agents be hackers and hang out with hackers in IRC chat rooms and you know, to talk about and participate in, you know, whatever different shenanigans that they're up to. And there are things that hacking groups use to test whether or not people are cops, you know, that work sometimes and don't work. But it really does change the balance of power when there is no resource limitation. You have unlimited mind power of an army of 13-year-olds who can all talk and gather information and remember, well, this guy from this IP address at this point said his was so-and-so and that he was connected to so-and-so. Like, this ability to collect massive amounts of data that could not ever have been just mass processed by a computer before, this kind of parsing and hands-on undercover work, basically, is an extraordinary thought.
You know, yeah, and I think that we're going to see both sides of that. You look at the complexity now of certain kinds of scams too, and you have like the phone things too, like, hey, let me speak to Brian. Hey, this is Brian. Hey, Brian, I want to tell you about a new offer. And you don't know if they have ones where they have one operator sending responses to like 15 people at a time. And so it's certainly going to make, you know, the scammers are going to use this too, and people trying to sell you stuff, and be a lot easier to make very personalized scam emails.
Oh my God. Would you realize, like, already there are, and we've talked about this on the show, I already get a number of robot. I guess I say they're robots, but they're not really robots. I pick up the phone and it sounds like a telemarketer saying like, hi, I'm so-and-so. I wanted to tell you about whatever. And then you'll ask like, wait, are you a robot? It's the same thing. They go, ha-ha, do I really sound that bad? And you're like, oh no, I guess you sound okay. And then they'll say, they'll say, well, anyway, I just needed to tell you about whatever. This is a case where they've actually created a soundboard, and rather than pay someone $15 to get hung up upon, which is a very miserable thing for telemarketers to do, they realized they could pay someone, you know, $5 an hour on the other side of the planet. Doesn't matter that they have an accent. They'll sound perfectly Western. They'll stick to the script because they can only click on the different trees that go on there. And I've said this before, but, you know, I'll immediately shortcut to be like, hey, are you a robot? And they're like, haha, do I really sound that bad? I'm like, great, that's awesome. I bet you're not a robot. Just do me a favor, say the word blue. And then they're like, oh, do I sound that bad? And they're like, B-L-U-E, just say that and we can have a great conversation. And then they hang up. But like, those days are numbered, man. What, 2 years you're going to be able to throw together a rudimentary algorithm that listens to me and has a conversation?
Yeah, and I mean, what, who knows what's in the lab at Google, let's say. You know, Ray Kurzweil, who, by the way, had made a bet with Mitch Kapor, I think was one of the founders of Lotus Notes, about a $20,000 bet. Kapor said, you know, no computer would pass the Turing test by 2029.
Wow, a wee bit ahead of schedule.
There'll be a debate about this because now it gets interesting because you'll have these things where it'll be like, but we meant this. And it's because like the computer posed as like a 12-year-old Ukrainian boy. And so, you know, already you're in your head making allowances for somebody. But I make a lot of allowances for people having, you know, free will that I'm not sure they do.
Yeah, no, we could get into that whole debate. If you believe in causality, then, you know, free will becomes an illusion.
There's a great article in Wired I recommend everybody check out if you're interested in the subject, though, because the area in which computers are still not better at us is the game of Go.
Oh, wow.
You know, Go is on the surface, a very simple game. You have black little stones and white stones, and the goal is to encircle your opponents. And it gets extremely complex. It's actually computationally far more complex than chess is. Chess has, in the opening moves, a finite number of moves of a certain amount. Go has an even greater number than that. It gets complex. And your grandmasters or your masters of Go talk about you reach a certain level. Then after that, and you have what I would describe it as sort of a gestalt sense of the board, where it's really hard for you to describe what it is. And computers can't get past that. The masters of Go consistently beat the best chess programs, our best computing programs that are trying to play the game of Go, which...
You know, it's weird, too, because we keep moving the fence back, right? So it's like when I was in high school, there were computers that could convincingly simulate. Like, if I were to play a game of Street Fighter II, and in that little universe, with that timing and in that 90-second bout with the punches, kicks, and jabs and movements or whatever... I would say that there's a number of computer-run artificial intelligence that could make me believe that a human was playing, you know, and part of it would be, I mean, whatever, good enough, right? And you could say, like, well, you know, in a perfect situation, it would learn and adjust and et cetera, et cetera. And you're right. And now we're at that point. Same thing with, like, chess. You know, chess bot can't think. They're not smart. And then, you know, then Deep Blue happens. Now we're in a world where the natural language capability of IBM's Watson is able to parse natural language questions. And I mean, it just feels like this is going to keep on moving forever, right? I mean, at some point, will we stop caring? Will we really have that her moment?
I think we're very close to the her moment, in a sense. Like, I think that given like what happened with this, you know, this Turing test, I think that we're very much at that point where you're going to have, you could design, because given how Eliza Fools has been fooling people for over a decade, certain kinds of people, now it's going to get that much more complicated. And, you know, imagine something that follows Google News and you start a conversation with like, oh, I saw this is interesting. Like, oh yeah, well, I saw this thing come up over here where Senator so-and-so said that. Like, oh, I don't know much about Senator so-and-so. And they might know like, oh, well, Andrew loves salacious gossip. Well, there was the thing where he did this, da 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 da. And I'm not getting a Wikipedia thing.
Sure.
I'm getting a conversational
And you're even
thing.
Getting the nuanced conversation of, it wouldn't just say, here, look at this article. It would say the tease of like, well, you heard about the so-and-so. And then based on your response, you're like, no, was it? And then I could even see it saying like, hang on, let me find the article. And wait, count off, you know, however many hundreds of milliseconds and before it pastes it in there. And they're like, check out that third paragraph where it says whatever.
And if it knows what I know or knows what you know, it does the same thing when I have a conversation with you. I give short form to things you already know. And they're like, oh, you know, let me expand on that. Or you did the same thing for me. Did you hear about this? And that's a very interesting sort of way to do that. So I think that it's fascinating where they go. And here's the thing is I had this, it was sort of interesting is that I you know, people like feel like, they're going to replace us. Like, some jobs are going to, if you're telemarketing, whatever, you're constantly at war with technology, you know, and a lot of information jobs are constantly at war, but the future is information jobs and how to manage these tools. One of the things that was kind of a significant thing that happened, you know, 20 years ago was the introduction of object-oriented computer programming was a big change in the sense that it used to be almost, you even have it up to that point, people like, I'm going to code in zeros and ones and sort of the assembler language and all that. But then you said, you know what? I can have a chunk of code that does a bunch of things. I don't need to know how it draws a circle or does this, whatever. I can just call it and make it happen. And AI is going to be more sophisticated, and we have that already. If you want to use voice recognition in an app, you can use a Google API and say, okay, whatever the person says in the microphone, figure out what they said and give me the words.
Right.
And then, and
so essentially, if you think of each of these object-oriented modules as an analog to different parts of the body, this is finally just a brain module or a conversation module of the interaction head of it.
Yeah. You know, I watched an interview with Matthew Reinhardt, who's designed a lot of the pop-up books I love, and he talks about how people often ask him, and this was sort of intuitive to me, I thought was interesting. People say, what program do you use to make those? And I thought, like, you know, that's kind of tantamount to, you know, 500 years ago, somebody shows me some amazing piece of sculpture. I'm like, well, what kind of chisel did you use? What did you do? What was the extension? What was the intermediary between you and your art to help create this? Now, his answer is he doesn't use one. But the point is we're so used to Photoshop, we're so used to these things, which has very intelligent behaviors in there, by the way, to do these things. You know, you can now use Photoshop to say, I need to copy this surface over here, and a computer behind the scenes does that. These things will be embedded into the tools, and we'll certainly be aware of the things we have conversations with, but the other ways these things assist us will continue to be invisible in a sense.
Well, and there's, if you want to see where this is going, and this is apparently the hooray for Wired Hour, because one of the best articles, and I think we mentioned it before, is The Better Than Human, Why Robots Will and Must Take Our Jobs. And it basically boils down to, there's a line, I'm going to see if I can find it here, talking about how, there we go, existing jobs, new jobs, current, so there's jobs today that humans do, but machines will eventually do better. There's current jobs that humans can't do, but machines can. And then there's new jobs coming that are jobs that only humans will be able to do at first. And then robot jobs that we can't even imagine yet, where robots are putting other robots to work. And all of this is only going to increase the pie for everyone. I mean, yes, it will. To anyone who's lost their job to a robot, I my deepest condolences. I understand that'll be a pain in the ass. But for humanity as a whole, it's just getting better for all of us. The more of the work we don't feel like doing, the robots do.
And I'm gonna do like a little personal aside. I have friends who are ahead of the curve on stuff, who are into these things and these technologies, who do things like listen to podcasts and stuff, and like what we're doing. And I have friends who do not. Friends who they did their 4 years in college and figured they were going to come out of college, the world was going to give them a high-paying job, and they were going to be set. And they found out that didn't work out that way, that the skills they had in college, you know, one, they paid way more for an education than it was actually worth, that they did not have the skill set beyond doing sales or other stuff like that. And my friends who move forward, my friends who do well, are my friends who are multi-skilled and who are always picking up new skills. They may not be the best at Photoshop, but they know how to use it. They may not be the best computer programmers, but they can pick up a book and they can say, I'm going to learn how to do this. The acquisition of skills is absolutely important. And you can sit there and say, I shouldn't have to. Then, yeah, you don't have to. But there's no rule that says that society has to carry you along. And there comes a point where we're carrying along too many people that we slow the overall progress down if you have the joy of learning something new.
I feel like the pie is going to get so big that that you'll have the option to either work or not work. 100 years from now, I feel like you could either contribute to the virtual economy and there'll be like a baseline that everyone gets just for freezies. But it'll basically be Second Life. Second Life is a world where there is no resource limitation and everyone gets the basic everything for free. But if you want to put forth the effort, you can get premium stuff.
I think we're kind of in that world, but that's when you get into, getting into like income disparities is a very sticky issue. And there's a very popular book out now that also just got torn apart by like the Wall Street Journal or Financial Times because the data seemed to be mucked with whatever. But people who have skills and work will outpace people who don't. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the first wave of people to go to Mars are going to be the people who are able to afford $500,000 seats, round trip tickets to go there. The people who are trying to get by and just what they can do, fine. And I think, yeah, the poorest population has steadily increased as far as quality of life. You know, you're much better off being poor in 2014 than you were in 1914. 1914 in America being poor literally meant borderline starvation.
Yeah.
You know, 2014 borderline poor meant I maybe don't have HBO and I have to steal. You know, it's a very dramatic.
I'm still on my parents' HBO Go account.
Yeah. But my point is that if you want to just ride along, that's fine. You're going to be envious of the people who are succeeding. But if you want to move forward, have skills, pick up stuff, pick up these things, be aware, you know? I mean, it's just, yeah, you know, why be a free rider?
Here's the part of the article that I loved that I was trying to find the words for. He says there's 7 steps to dealing with robots taking over your job. Step 1, a robot or computer can't possibly do what I do later. Step 2. All right, it could do a lot of them, but it can't do everything I do later. Step 3. All right, it could do everything I do, except it needs me when it breaks, which is a lot later. Step 4. All right, it operates flawlessly on routine stuff, but I need to train it for new tasks. Step 5. All right, it can have my old boring job because it's obvious that was not a job that humans were meant to do. 6. Wow, now that robots are doing my old job, my new job is much more fun and pays more. Step 7. I'm so glad a robot or computer cannot possibly do what I do now. I think that's it. I think that's the world we're headed to. And boring chit-chat, there's going to be a podcast bot that's able to do the kind of conversations that you and I are doing.
Yeah. I have a friend whose father, once he got retired from IBM, he could not find a job. He spent 30 years at IBM as the typewriter repairman.
There are people, if you're somebody who that's really what floats your boat and you want to do it forever, it's a bummer that there's not any typewriters to repair. Although you could make the argument that, you know, he now owns a very niche market and could charge a lot of money for.
Well, there were a lot of other typewriter repairmen who went out of business the same time he did.
Okay, that's a good point.
And I guess my point was, but this was a guy that was not prepared for, you know, what happens next. Like my father spent 30 years in the ATF, and we're like, what's my dad going to do when he retires? Because all he knows how to do is like kick in doors and arrest people, you know? What's he going to do? And my dad loved fly fishing. And my dad ended up being a guy who was a rep for fly rod companies. And then he evolved into when the company he worked for got sold overseas, whatever, he knew so much about fly rods, he could go to fly fishing shops and they would give him his rods to sell on eBay. So now my dad has a thriving business on eBay buying and selling fishing fly rods. My dad's not a computer inclined person. My dad is not a computer. He will go to Google to type in the name of a website to go to the website, right?
Yeah.
But he knows eBay. He knows how to do this stuff. And he's like, well, I'll do this now. And he's a guy that mastered that little bit of technology and how to do that wonderfully well.
Do you think there's a fundamental change in people nowadays where we have no expectation of doing one thing for the rest of our lives? In fact, if anyone's watching in the chat, if you felt like you're going to do the same thing forever or not, let us know there. I think it's fascinating.
I think some people do. I think that's the problem. I think you have some people do. There's that weird entitlement sense, you know. And I think that, you know, you and I were cut from similar cloth in the sense that being entertainers, being people who have always lived within, you know, whatever our capabilities were and knew that, like, we did not plan on, I'm going to get that 30-year job with the big company. We were like, I'm going to build my own thing. It'll be good times, it'll be bad times, but overall, it'll even out for the better.
Well, but think about it. You and I also have changed our careers to, we were both full-time touring stage magicians at one point. And both of us, totally independent of each other, realized, like, do I want to be 65 years old still doing this in this same circuit with these same people for the millionth time? And we both realized, like, no, I need to be seeing what is something I would like to do that's peripherally related, that's scalable in the long term. And both of us decided to look into podcasting, and then both of us looked into TV, and I mean, it's amazing how everything's changing.
But I have friends, and you do too, that are entertainers, been doing the same thing for 20 years, 25 years, and they're realizing, oh no, now what? And they don't have other skills. You know, the job they'll take after
after 25 years entertainment would be the job they could have gotten 25 years ago.
Right. Well, and oftentimes if you don't have that idea of like what's next or what's down the road, then, you know, a lot of folks, the only skill they have is they have all their contacts and they know the circuit. So they go into booking other people. So a lot of them go into the agency side of things, which is fine. I think it's a fine place, but I knew for sure that wasn't what I was interested in doing, which is why, I mean, it took 5-6 years it was a 6-year journey from Scam School starting to me suddenly looking up and realizing, holy crap, I haven't done a college show in months.
Yep. And it's like, as entertainers, you're like, ah, we provide a very special form of entertainment. Grant, and motion pictures, everything else has been steadily eroding us. And then, oh yeah, Tupac, Michael Jackson, they're dead. Doesn't matter. You know, we can bring them back.
By the way, the magician in the chat says he's been doing street magic for 2 years and stage for 3. Dude, that's great. You're actually just now ramping up to prime time. It takes a good 3 or 4 years to finally break in and start making decent money. What I predict you'll see is 3 years from now, the magician, you'll be doing so good that you'll wonder if you want to do anything else with the rest of your life, which I'm going to tell you is a pretty good time to start wondering what else you want to do with the rest of your life.
Or the alternate path is going to be like, hello, welcome to the Apple Store. Here's my suggestion, the magician. Have a business plan. Have a business plan. If you already have a degree or in training in business, that's great. Go take some night school stuff, whatever. The guys who really get ahead, and what Brian takes for granted is Brian has a very, very down-to-earth approach when he thinks about money, when he thinks about, you know, where is this going to lead, what's going to be the next thing. And that's rare among performers. I think that you have a much better idea of a business plan and how you progress on things. And you may say, do you think you don't, Brian? But compared to other entertainers,
no, you're right. And I'll go ahead and say, you know, we give picks and stuff. This is a side pick. The whole reason that happened is I don't think I've told this story here before. 2 years after I quit my day job, I had hired a agent to book me, and he booked me with the busiest fall I was ever going to have. And unfortunately, I had to pay him for the 8 months leading up to that. And this is a time that I had absolutely no tangible assets. I had a car that was probably negative in value or whatever, that, you know, living rent, you know, renting or whatever. And I did the math, and it just, you know, I had to pay my agent a monthly salary every month up until those gigs started coming in. And I watched my debt get to the pants crappingly high $60,000 mark, all on credit cards. And I'm like, I don't have this. If I sold everything I have, what am I going to do? And I was like, all right, let's look at the numbers. I think it was closer to $50,000. I said, let's look at the numbers. Let's look at the, because I want to be accurate here. I said, let's look at the numbers. If I make it to all 45, 50 of these shows, and I don't miss a single one, and I don't have a mishap, and I don't break my leg, and I don't whatever, then let's see, I could expect to get back to zero. And that was so utterly heartbreaking that I was going to have my best year by the numbers of earning, and the best it would do is get me back to zero. And so Bonnie suggested, she's like, well, you need to learn how to deal with money. So buy some financial books. So I bought a bunch. And the one that stuck out was a book written in the early 1900s called The Richest Man in Babylon. That is a set of parables set in ancient Babylon. And what's great about it is because it takes place in ancient Babylon, they don't talk about dollars. They don't talk about money. They talk about gold coins. And this guy is the best charioteer in all the land, but he can't understand why he could barely make his rent. And his friend is the best bard in the land, but he could barely make his rent. Meanwhile, their friend, who in school was dumber and slower and lazier than they were, is the richest man of Babylon. And they say, well, explain to us how. And I highly recommend it. It was life-changing to me because the core principle of it was a part of everything you earn is yours to keep. And the response to that was, well, that's dumb. I thought everything I earned was mine to keep. And they're like, well, it's the end of the month. How much do you have? He's like, well, I had to give some for the rent. I had to give some for the fuel and for school and all this stuff. And it's like, exactly. Part of what you earn is yours to keep. And the metaphor that stuck with me was the opening lesson. He said, what would happen if every morning you put 10 eggs in a basket and every evening you took 9 eggs out? And the response was like, well, by the end of the month, you'd be overflowing with eggs. And the guy's like, exactly. And that to me was the core fundamental. So to get back to your point, Andrew, it's been 14 years now. I know. Yeah, I guess 14 years that I've been a very fastidious saver which has made it possible to make those shifts.
And I'll tell you that book and the core idea there is a very important one. And that's one that when you start looking at like wealth gaps and that, and they go like, oh, the richest, you know, is getting rich at this rate while the other part isn't. And it comes down to this. If you're building debt or if you're investing, the investor will always outpace the person building debt. And, you know, we tend to think about investing meaning large amounts of money, but it's not. It's not. It can be – even when I was – you know, when, you know, things were really, really rough for me, I would still put $20 away every month. I would always make that habit of doing that. And then when things were better, I would do more or whatever just to have that habit of doing that because, you know, I was fortunate in, you know, investing some things and, you know, companies like Apple early on and other places like that that was really able to, you know, make my life a little bit smoother than a lot of other people who have shiftless sort of careers like I have. But the end of the day is, I guess, is that habit, and it gets into short-term gratification. But like, you know, every one of my friends I've ever had that conversation, like, yeah, if I had the money, we're sitting in a bar and they have their second beer. You know, is there this? And it's like, it's, there's the little things.
Well, and that's the thing is when you write a plan, you break it down into pieces small enough that you end up with an individual piece so small you can do it right now. You know, like something right this minute. Like, let's say part of your plan is to be, you know, a famous whatever, and you realize that part of that plan is that you need to have written a book. And then, in order to write that book, you need to brainstorm whatever. And it eventually gets to the point where you finally decide, well, here's something I could do right now. Let me open up Word and type in 25 different subjects that I'd like to write a book on. And the difference is a lot of people don't ever take that one action step or whatever.
And you know, I become much more efficient when I figured out how to maximize all of my time to do things I want to do. Like, I'm writing, like, I have notebooks all around me for book ideas. I have on my phone, I type in little ideas for stuff. I have like 6 books ahead mapped out for what I want to do. And, you know, I'm still involved in TV. Tons of magic tricks played out, working on another television show project with my friends and always trying to do that stuff. And so I maybe spend more amount of my time working on work than maybe I should, but I don't know how less I should.
Well, look, I mean, regardless, I mean, we don't want to change this into the Weird Success podcast, but I'll tell you what, in the interest of saving time on picks, that'll be my pick, is The Richest Man in Babylon.
All right. Good pick. My pick will be, I played this game. And I went to New York. I went for Book Expo America. I had a great time. That's why I was able to do the podcast. I had a wonderful time there. It was just a neat experience. But whenever I go on a trip, that's my excuse to play games. I don't play games when I'm at home. I rarely do. I'll have maybe if I have friends over, I might play something to be social. But like, I just try to make my things I do for fun social. But when I go on a trip, I'm like, listen, I'm on an airplane. I can do whatever I want. And I played the game Monument Valley.
I don't know Monument Valley. What is that one?
So Monument Valley is an iOS game, and it's on Android. It's by a gaming company called Us2. And that's another thing I want to point out, by the way, is that, you know, if you're – there's so many awesome tools and things out there for people who are willing to learn how to use skills and things like that. I love the fact that some of the top video games now are 2- and 3-man development teams or woman teams, you know, and – Monument Valley is basically a video game, like for our handheld game. It's kind of like an M.C. Escher thing came to life.
Okay.
And so you have to figure out how to navigate through this landscape. And as Brian's looking at this video right now, you see this girl, you know, she's walking up steps, but then the steps sometimes go back down. And then you have to avoid crow people. It's very simple kind of gameplay, but it's based upon these sort of optical illusions and that you may not see a path until you look at it from a different direction.
Oh, this is great. This, you know what this reminds me of is there's a experimental project called I want to say Scale, that instead of like a gravity gun, you would walk up close to an object so it looked really big to you, and then you would click on it, and then and it would fuse that object into being really big so you can move it and set it somewhere else. This seems like very much in the same vein.
Yeah, and you know, one great example I heard somebody says is, you know, like every frame could be a poster, and it's absolutely true. You can actually take snapshots from the game. And so I'm looking at you know, the team that made this was 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, like eight people, you know, an 8-person team spent 10 months to create, I think is one of the, and they take a game like Threes, which is even more simpler, which is just captivating.
Yeah. By the way, I've gotten on my high horse now. Every time someone mentions 2048, I'm like, please consider playing Threes, the game that 2048 is a shameless ripoff of.
Yeah, that's funny because, like, yeah, I remember there was, like, the talk about, 24-8 is wonderful and visual. And someone's like, hey, listen, you got to go look at Threes. That's the original. And that whole, yeah, like, Threes is like, I've taken that off. I allowed myself to play Threes. I mean, literally, I'm like a guy with a heroin addiction. I'm like, all right, I'm going to go out of town. I can do a little Threes when I'm there.
Just
when I come
as long
home,
as it's there, man. That's just my New York thing. I don't play Threes in LA.
I'm playing no more Threes. And so, like, I got to check to see if I deleted Threes when I got home. I did. I deleted Threes when I got back. I absolutely did. And so that's the thing. And Monument Valley, I like because it's there's a beginning, middle, and end. There's a storyline to it. It is I just loved it. I loved it. Like, again, I'm a
all right,
much
this is one that I know that I'll love and that my daughter will love. So I'm gonna pick it up right away. I do want to say real quick, I've been playing on the live streams and I'm almost done with it. But Wolfenstein, The New Order, is right. So it's got this uncanny valley. I'm unfairly hard on this game because the story is fantastic. The cinematics are great. The set pieces are unfathomably amazing to watch. It starts off like every other World War II game, only it's a bit over the top in that you see giant mechs walking and so on. But then you take shrapnel in your head, you're blown out for 15 years as you sit there and watch the world flash in front of you like a stop motion photography. And then finally you come to in 1960s and the Nazis have taken over everything. And then, boom, opening credits, right? Because I love the game so much, I am having an agonizingly tough time with a few minor flaws in the game level design. There's probably been like four times when I wasted 30 minutes because the level looked to me like it wanted me to solve it a certain way. But then secretly I was like, oh, you mean I had to do that the whole time? Or I thought you told me I needed to do this, you know, and just those moments take so much out of me that it keeps me from, you know, calling it like a game of the year by any stretch. But I will say it may be the game story of the year for me.
Wow. Wow. I don't have quite the breadth of knowledge of games you do, sir.
That's okay. Just say, I believe you.
I believe you. I believe you. You are a person that can control these demons far better than I can.
Or at least channel them.
Yeah,
learn to live stream them.
Everybody, watch me play video games.
Yeah, man. So that's good. And I guess
everybody watch me write.
You just got to do snarky commentary about your own writing as it happens.
Brian?
Yeah, man.